Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Our speaker tonight is Dr. Dilip Jesty, who's incidentally the director of the Stein Institute, and who will be talking about wisdom and successful aging. So introducing him is a major challenge because you get a page and a half of all of his accomplishments. But I will summarize briefly: is the Estelle and Edgar Levi Chair in Aging and the director of the Stein Institute for Research on Aging, and also a distinguished professor of psychiatry and neurosciences at the University of California, San Diego. He's also the director of the Advanced Center for Innovations and Services and Intervention Research at UCSD, which is funded by the National Institutes of Mental Health. He is funded by several research grants and is the author or co-author on over 600 publications in peer-reviewed journals. He has published 10 books and is also the editor of the American Journal of Geriatric Psychiatry. He's the former president of the American Association for Geriatric Psychiatry and the West Coast College of Biological Psychiatry, and also the founding president of the International College of Geriatric Psychoneuropharmacology. He is listed also as one of the best doctors in America, and received a number of awards for his clinical work as well as for his research. And he is also, I guess on a personal note, what I've found him most known for is a wonderful mentor and encourager of young people to understand and work towards careers in geriatric psychiatry and mental health and aging. And I think has spurred many of us to study this field, and in particular in this new field of successful aging. So without further any ado, I will introduce Dr. Jesty.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Dr. Deb, for a kind introduction. It's actually an honor to be introduced by Colin Deb. Colleagues like him who have grown up in the department and have become major researchers in the world are a matter of pride for all of us. Usually in these public lectures, it is my job to introduce the speaker. So today it's actually a privilege for me to give the talk itself. So I will be talking on wisdom and successful aging. I'm going to begin with a brief historical perspective of wisdom. Then I will summarize our attempts to find common elements in the definition of wisdom. Next, discuss some literature on neurobiology of wisdom. The question is there a seat for wisdom in the brain? Next, what is the relationship of wisdom to aging in general and successful aging in particular? Next, neuroplasticity of aging. This is one of the most exciting areas in neuroscience research in the last 15 years. And finally, what are the implications of all this, implications of wisdom and successful aging? As many of you know, wisdom has been largely a religious and philosophical concept. Sophia is the Greek goddess of wisdom. The word philosophy, derived from philos and sophia, and literally means lover of wisdom. Interestingly, there are more goddesses of wisdom than gods of wisdom in different religions. Just goes on to show that people always knew that women are wiser than men. there is a long-standing religious and philosophical tradition. In the Bible, there are 7 books of wisdom. The most famous of these is, of course, the Book of Solomon or Wisdom of Solomon. There has, however, been relatively little scientific research on wisdom. There is a kind of a pseudo-scientific attempt at localizing wisdom in the brain by Gall in the early part of the 19th century. He developed what is called phrenology. He suggested that the bumps on our skull represent different psychological ability areas, such as intelligence, love. One of those was sagacity or wisdom. And interestingly, he located that on the front part of the brain, covering what today we would call the prefrontal cortex. As I said, the work on wisdom in research has been rather recent. It was in 1970s that gerontologists, sociologists, and psychologists became interested in wisdom. We did a PubMed search to find out how many papers there are on wisdom that were published over the decades. In 1970, there were only about 15 papers on wisdom. In the last decade, that number has increased to 350. So clearly, this is an area that is attracting public interest and increasingly scientific interest. When we talk about wisdom, the usual question is, how do you define wisdom? Different people define wisdom differently. So we wanted to start our work by doing a literature review and finding out what are the definitions that other investigators have used over the last 40 years. We found about a dozen definitions of wisdom published in the literature. So my colleague Trey Meeks and I, we sought out those elements that were common to at least three definitions of wisdom. And we found out six such elements. And I have listed them not in any order of priority or importance. One of them is pragmatic knowledge of life or social decision making. How does a person make decisions in everyday life? Second is emotional regulation. Ability of a person to control the emotions so they don't fluctuate widely. Next one is pro-social attitudes and behaviors. So this includes things like compassion, empathy, altruism, doing things for others. Then comes reflection or self-understanding, insight, sort of knowing yourself. Then dealing effectively with uncertainty and ambiguity. As we all know, most situations in life are not black and white, they're gray. And yet, we have to make decisions. So how does a person make decisions? And finally, something that may be uniquely human is what may be called value relativism or tolerance. This is tolerance of divergent values. For example, you may have strong opinions about something, say like stem cell research, and yet you can accept the fact that somebody else may have opposite opinion, and yet the other person may also be right, or the other person has a right to have a different opinion. So that kind of value relativism or tolerance may be something that is really a sign of not just human nature, but probably higher level wisdom. So those are the common elements we found from the definitions published in the literature. Next thing we wanted to do was we wanted to poll the experts on wisdom in the world today and find out what they thought. So we did a study using what is called the Delphi method or RAND panel method. We polled about 30 international experts on wisdom. These experts were identified on the basis of their publications and reputation in the field. And we asked them whether wisdom was different from intelligence on one hand and spirituality on the other. Because clearly these three things share some elements. And the question was, is wisdom really distinct or is it just part of those two things? So we gave them a list of characteristics, about 45 to 50, and asked them to rate these characteristics on wisdom, intelligence, and spirituality. We found that there was a surprising consensus among these experts. They agreed that wisdom was distinctly different. There was an overlap, obviously. Wisdom does include intelligence. Wisdom does include pro-social behaviors, which are part of spirituality, but they are not identical. Wisdom also includes a bunch of other things. And the overall consensus was that wisdom is a complex, uniquely human trait, which involves not just cognitive development, but also emotional development. It is experience-driven, it can be learned, and it increases with age. The elements that were acknowledged by these experts as being common to wisdom were rich knowledge of life, practical life skills, emotional regulation, social cognition, social cooperation, insight, tolerance of ambiguity, and value relativism, tolerance of diversity. These are exactly the same elements that I mentioned earlier based on the review of definition. So it's interesting that there is considerable similarity between these experts' thinking and the definitions in the literature. They also suggested a few other things like openness to new experience, successful coping strategies, resilience, and sense of humor. But the similarities were important. At the same time, both of those, the literature review as well as the expert, these are modern Western definitions. So one question was, how would these definitions relate to very ancient Eastern philosophy and religion? With that in mind, we looked at what may be called the Hindu Bible, that is the Bhagavad Gita. My colleague Ipsit Wahia and I looked at the Gita, which literally the word Bhagavad Gita means the song of the God or the song of the Divine One. This was written several hundred years BC, and it is based on the Yogas, which were written several thousand years BC. The modern Western thinking is primarily based on Greek philosophers' writings, Aristotle, Plato, Socrates, and really has nothing to do with the writing in the Gita, which came from thousands of years ago in an entirely different part of the world. So there is no reason why there should be much similarity between the concept of wisdom in the Gita and the modern Western concept. What we did was we used to mix qualitative-quantitative methodology with the help of a medical anthropologist. We used two translations of Gita in English. One was by a Westerner and one was by a Hindu Swami. We use Oxford Dictionary, Rogers Thesaurus, a Sanskrit lexicon. And we wanted to find out how many times the word wisdom or its synonym sagacity or their opposites, folly or foolishness, were used in the Gita and in what context. So the main issue was in what context were those terms used. And this kind of software helps you analyze the data in terms of the context. Using that, we found these as elements of wisdom in the Gita: general knowledge of life, emotional regulation, compassion, sacrifice, insight, humility, and decisiveness. These are five of the six elements that I mentioned earlier based on the Western definitions. So it's really remarkable that the basic concept of wisdom has not changed over centuries and across geographic boundaries. There were a few other elements too, of course. Duty and work, self-contentedness. This is a religious document, so there was love of God. This also reflects Eastern philosophy. So it emphasizes renunciation of materialistic pursuits. In most of the Western definitions of wisdom, that would not be an element. The main point, though, is the commonalities. It is really impressive that the basic construct of wisdom was similar in the documents written thousands of years apart and tens of thousands of miles apart. What it suggests is that wisdom may not be purely a socio-cultural concept, but probably is biologically based. It is something that is a part of innate human brain, if you will. Which then raises the question, is there neurobiology of the wisdom? Or where in the brain may wisdom be located? Now, how do you decide whether certain ability is located in the brain? How do you decide its location? For some things, it is easy to do. For example, there is what is called area number 4, Brodmann's area 4, in the frontal cortex that are associated with motor activity. How do you know that? If you stimulate area 4, the person moves his limb. On the other hand, if that area is damaged, then the person becomes paralyzed. So it is easy to know that area 4 represents motor activity. How do you do that with wisdom? Obviously, it is difficult. We can't stimulate an area and suddenly person becomes wise. That'll be hard to decide. The reverse is not hard, though. If an area is damaged, can that produce loss of wisdom? So that was our question. Is there literature suggesting that damage to specific parts of the brain results in loss of wisdom? And the damage can be of two types. One is brain injury, so head injury, specific area, and diseases of the brain. And I will talk in the next few slides about examples of both damage and disease causing loss of wisdom. And then I will also present a review of literature in which we looked at neuroimaging studies in normal people. So starting with brain damage, some of you may have heard the famous case of Phineas Gage. Phineas Gage was a simple common man in the 19th century. He was a railroad construction worker in Vermont. This is his basic description. He was not highly educated, but he was a nice person. He was a smart person, got along well with others, helped others. He was a shrewd businessman. So everybody thought of him as a wise man. Then he had a very bizarre accident. While working as a construction worker, there was a wide explosion. And a large iron rod went through the back of his left eye and came through the top of his head. You would think that accident like that would probably kill a person. It was miraculous he not only survived, but he recovered almost completely. He had no physical signs except for blindness in the left eye. Also, most of his cognitive abilities were reasonably intact. The only thing that changed, and that changed dramatically, was his personality. This is his description by his own personal physician after his injury. He described him as having become fitful, irreverent, profane, non-deferential, impatient, obstinate, capricious, vacillating, devising, childish, exact opposite of wisdom. You remember the elements I have talked about in wisdom: social decision making, emotional regulation, pro-social behavior, insight, decisiveness. You see that all of those elements are lost. And where was the damage? The damage was more or less restricted to left prefrontal cortex. There have been studies of his skull that have been published in Science and other journals. So an example of a very restricted damage causing loss of wisdom. That's not the only case. There have been a number of other cases reported since then. One of the most modern cases is that described by researchers at UCSD, Dr. Dean Dulles and Alison Cato, who is actually our research fellow now. They describe a 26-year-old man who had exemplary academic and professional record. He was in the military. He also had a bizarre accident. He was on the passenger seat. There's a wide explosion. There was damage to both the prefrontal cortex on both sides, especially on the left side. They did extensive neuropsychological testing, and they found that in many areas he was quite normal. His IQ was 119. And yet, his social functioning declined precipitously. He could not hold a job. The best job he did was that of a newspaper delivery person. He got married and had a marital breakup 3 times, estranged from his children. Very different from the person he was before his accident, and again with fairly localized damage to his prefrontal cortex. So that's about injury. What about diseases? There is one disease called frontotemporal dementia. It is one of the more common types of dementia. We all know about Alzheimer's dementia. Alzheimer's usually occurs after the age of 65 and is characterized by memory loss. Frontotemporal dementia occurs earlier in life, usually in the 50s, and memory loss is not a characteristic feature. The main symptom, change in personality. And these are the sign symptoms. Poor social decision making, loss of personal social awareness, disinhibition, impulsivity, sociopathy, lack of empathy, emotional coldness, apathy, poor insight, self-centeredness. Once again, exact antithesis of wisdom. And there are subtypes of this in which the damage is more or less restricted to left prefrontal cortex. So these are examples that suggest that fairly localized damage or disease of the brain can result in changes that affect wisdom. We did a literature review then of studies of neuroimaging primarily that related to specific components of wisdom, such as compassion, altruism, emotional regulation, and so on. And we found that there are some parts of the brain that were overrepresented in this area. One is dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. One is ventromedial prefrontal cortex, anterior cingulate. These three, by the way, are part of the prefrontal cortex. And then there is amygdala, which is kind of center for emotions. And that's a part also of the limbic striatum. One noteworthy thing, prefrontal cortex is the newest part of the brain in the evolution. Whereas the limbic striatum is the oldest part of the brain in evolution. So what we have proposed is that wisdom involves a balance between the oldest and the newest parts of the brain. A simplistic way of looking at this is this, that I mentioned four areas of the brain. One of them is dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. Think about it as proverbial father whose job is to be rational, cold, calculating, competitive, that tells you what to do, what not to do for your own sake. The ventromedial prefrontal cortex is like proverbial mother, emotional, kind, supportive, social. In some ways, if you think about it, this part is necessary for one's own survival. This part is necessary for survival of the species, so we don't become totally selfish. And of course, these two don't always go hand in hand. So sometimes there is a conflict. So when there is a conflict, we go to our uncle or aunt. So that's the anterior cingulate. And at the same time, we always need a friend on whose shoulder we can cry. And that's a proverbial friend, that's the limbic striatum. So wisdom can be conceptualized as balance among these structures, which help us behave in a way that is useful to us and the society. So what does wisdom have to do with aging? What happens with aging to the brain? Now we know that with aging, several things decline. We become slower as we age. We become physically slower, we become mentally slower also. It becomes harder to do quick things in contrast to our kids or grandkids who are handling 10 different things at the same time. Reaction time slows, working memory. Recall becomes difficult. I may have somebody's name on the tip of my tongue, but I just can't get it. I just can't recall it. Some aspects of executive function, learning new things also becomes harder. Some of these new gadgets that come on market all the time, the kids can learn so fast, and older age becomes a little harder to learn. Does that mean everything goes down with age, though? No. The things I described in the last slide are what is called fluid mechanics. They decline with age. There are other things that don't decline with age. These are called crystallized pragmatics. For example, I told you that we have difficulty in recalling somebody's name. But if you give me a list of five people, I will say exactly that the third person, that's the one I was thinking about. That means recognition is intact. Recall is difficult, but recognition is intact. That means that name is stored somewhere in my memory, and that is fine. Similarly, autobiographical memory is intact. People remember, even at the age of 80, what happened when they were 15 years old. They may not remember what they ate for breakfast yesterday, but they will remember what happened when they were 15. So autobiographical memory remains intact. Vocabulary remains intact and even increases in people who read and write. And then there are some interesting examples of people who think that actually they become better with age. Dr. Montalcini got Nobel Prize in Medicine in 1982. Last year she celebrated her 100th birthday. And she said, at that time, my mind is sharper today than when I was 20. Now, isn't that remarkable for somebody to even say that? Another Nobel laureate, Eric Kandel, he said that at the age of 77, this was a quote from Wall Street Journal, he said that, I think I do science better now than I did when I was younger. In science, judgment is so important. And now I have a better understanding of which problems are important and which are not. So he's talking about improved judgment as he became older. Now, of course, you would say that these are Nobel laureates, they are geniuses, and what happens to most average people? As people become old, we know that clearly the physical abilities go down. Physical diseases start happening. And then there are psychosocial stressors. So you would think that most people, as they get older, would become more unhappy, more stressed out, and their quality of life would be significantly lower. Does that happen, though? As Colin mentioned, we published this book, Successful Cognitive and Emotional Aging, and this is the focus that we have been following for the last 5-6 years. The one question is, how do you define successful aging? So we started with a review of the literature, and there is no single definition of successful aging. We found 28 studies that between them had 29 different definitions. But the most commonly used definition was physical health. Most people think about successful aging as meaning absence of disease and absence of disability. So the usual notion of successful aging is at the age of 90, you can climb a mountain and you can run a marathon. Unfortunately, that doesn't happen to most of us. So we wanted to find out, what do people really think as they age? So we did a study of 3,000 seniors in San Diego County. That's a study we have been doing it for the last several years. And we gave them a detailed survey. One question we asked was, rate yourself on successful aging on a scale from 1 to 10. 1 is worse, 10 is best. And you just rate yourself. We didn't tell them how we define successful aging. We said, you define it whatever way you want to, but just tell us where you are on that scale. And then, of course, we looked at a bunch of other things. So as I said, we have studied more than 3,000 people. These are people from local retirement communities, as well as people participating in some of the ongoing studies at UCSD. The only people we excluded were those in nursing homes, because they could not have completed a survey. Most people were between 60 and 102 years of age. And these were not super normal elderly. These were average older people. A usual sort of typical person in this study was an 80-year-old woman who is a widow. She lost her husband a few years ago. She has arthritis, diabetes, hypertension. She had a heart attack a few years ago. She lives by herself. She has some friend. She does some things. But financially, she's okay, not great. So she has clearly psychosocial stressors. She has physical stressors. So what would you think she would give herself on a scale of 1 to 10? Again, 1 is the worst, 10 is the best. So we thought that most people would rate themselves 3, 4, or 5. Oh, I should mention that most of these people, as I said, had physical illnesses and disabilities. Only 38% were free of disability, only 28% had no disease. So most people had disease and disability. What we found was that these people gave themselves 7, 8, 9, or 10 on the successful aging scale. The mean rating was 8.4. That's really remarkable. That objectively, you would think that these people are not aging well, and yet subjectively, they thought they were doing quite well. And it is not just they thought that they were doing well. They also met several other non-physical criteria for successful aging. They didn't meet the physical criteria, but the non-physical. For example, most of them were living independently. That does not mean that they didn't need help. Some of these people were in wheelchairs, but they had control over their time, their control over most of what they could do. Positive adaptation, active engagement with life, mastery, growth, life satisfaction, cognitive function. So they were doing quite well psychosocially and behaviorally, not necessarily physically. We also ran some focus group and individual interviews because talking to the people actually helps you understand how they are feeling more than some of these numbers from the data. And so I will just show you a few quotes in these two slides. So one person said, successful aging is not a matter of chronology, as it's a matter of attitude and frame of mind. Another said, a lot of traumatic things happen in life. Set those types of trauma aside, look back at them with interest, and move on from there. Always think positively. You have to be optimistic. And this is my favorite. Person said, on my 100th birthday, I'm going to stop and think about what I'm going to do with the rest of my life. So that kind of a positive attitude, kind of a Nike attitude, we can do in spite of whatever disabilities we may have. We also completed several individual interviews. Actually, there was a medical student who conducted this study. One of our participants said, every time we do something new, it's a new adventure. You have to learn new skills. I have reinvented myself a dozen times. So if you think about wisdom, thinking about people, how their judgment improves with age, and this is it's very interesting. This person said, when I was busy working, I just worked and paid bills, and all that turned into what? And I came here. He came to a social organization, which was an advocacy group. And he said, I always wanted to help other people, but I couldn't do that earlier, but now I got the opportunity. If I can do something for somebody and knowing that I'm not expecting anything back, I'm doing it just because I enjoy doing it, makes me feel great inside. So you see there is an increase in pro-social behavior, altruism, compassion, empathy that occurs with aging. So if you look at it in sort of totality, it looks like as people are getting older, in spite of physical illnesses, disabilities, psychosocial stressor, they feel better, they become more pro-social, they keep themselves active, they feel that they have better judgment than they had when they were younger. And that is the paradox of aging, that on the one hand, the physical health declined, some cognitive abilities declined, such as memory. On the other hand, the physical, mental health and psychosocial functioning tend to improve. Now, when I present those findings, people outside California, they say, oh, wow, you live in California. And so the California people are always weird. So the results in California may not apply to the rest of the country, or rest of the world. This was a study that was just recently completed. It's coming out in Proceedings of National Academy of Sciences. Gallup phone survey of more than 340,000 Americans across the country. And they looked at psychological well-being. So similar to our question, they asked people how you feel you are doing. And this is really the bottom line. So this shows self-rated global well-being by age. So people feel pretty good about themselves in early 20s. Then that feeling starts going down, hits the bottom around 45, 50. Then it starts improving. And people start feeling better about themselves than what they are doing as they age. So this is not a phenomenon unique to San Diego or California, but really we see that across the country and actually across the world. Does it have anything to do with wisdom? Quite likely. This is a study done by Monica Ardell a number of years ago. And she said this is the bottom line, essentially, that wisdom has a profoundly positive influence on life satisfaction. more so than physical health, social, financial situation. That people who are wiser, they feel better about themselves, they do better, whether they have physical illnesses and psychosocial disabilities or not. But does wisdom really increase with aging? This is a study, again, very recent study that is also coming out in Proceedings of National Academy of Sciences. Just look at this last conclusion. In this study, they found that social reasoning seemed to improve with age in spite of decline in fluid intelligence. Fluid intelligence is things like working memory, recall, the usual stuff that I talked about. And what is social reasoning? Greater use of higher order reasoning schemes that emphasize need for multiple perspectives, allowing for compromises, recognizing limits of knowledge. Essentially judgment, pro-social behavior. So those things improve, and that's what makes people feel better. So there is increasing evidence that wisdom may be improving with age. But then how is that possible? That we know that with age, the various physical and even the brain abilities go down. There is clearly some degenerative change that occurs in the brain. So how can anything get better with aging? So that is the neuroplasticity of aging. What it means is that the brain continues to be plastic in old age. In other words, the brain can be modified by behavior and environment, not just in children, not just in young adults, but even in older people. How does this occur? There are two possible mechanisms. One is called compensation. The other is neurogenesis and synaptogenesis. Talk about that in the next couple of slides. This is based on a study of fMRI, functional magnetic resonance imaging, in response to a memory task. And there are three groups of people. And this is the average of each of those groups. So this is a group of young people who did the task well. This is the average of older people who did not do that as well. This is the average of the older people who did that as well. Okay, so those are the three groups. What do we find in younger people? By the way, these red, yellow area, those represent the parts of the brain that are activated during this test. So we see in young people who did that as well, that the activation only on one side of the brain. Old people who did not do that as well, activation on one side of the brain. Old people who did the test well, there's activation on both sides of the brain. In other words, in older age, you need to have more neurons, more circuits involved to do the same thing that you could do with fewer neurons and circuits in younger age. It is like this. When I was younger and stronger, I could push a heavy cart with one hand. As I get older, it's hard for me to push it, but if I use both hands, I can still do it. So that's what is compensation, that you need to compensate for the declining ability in one area by recruiting other parts of the brain that are still okay. But you can still do that. Even more exciting is this work on neurogenesis, synaptogenesis, which means that new neurons and new synapses can form in old age. This was a study done by Dr. Rusty Gage, who is at Salk and UCSD, and a number of other investigators have replicated these findings in various other species too. In this study, what they did was they took some old mice and randomly divided them into two groups. One group of old mice was brought up in the usual cages. In a typical cage for mice, there are about 3-4 mice in a cage, and they don't have to do anything, really. They are there 24/7, they are given food, there is a water supply continuously, there is not much space to run around. And so that's the usual life for most of these lab mice. They put the other randomly selected group of old mice in kind of a Disneyland for mice. So there are large open fields, they could run around, there were roller coasters, different colors, they could choose different things. So lots of excitement, new things, stimulation, that was there. After 3 months, and 3 months is a long time in mice, mice live for between 2 and 3 years. After 3 months, they found that these mice had significantly increased number of neurons and synapses. The neurons had increased not in all parts of the brain, but specific parts of the brain, mainly the dentate gyrus of the hippocampus and periventricular area. On the other hand, synapses, which are really the junctions between two neurons, they seem to increase over wider parts of the brain. But that really is exciting. It means that it is not only in children that there is development. Development can occur even in old age, provided there is this kind of psychosocial stimulation. Now, one might say this occurs in mice. Does it occur in humans? I'm just going to show you one study here. This was a study that was published in Nature, which is the number one journal in science. This was a study in young adults, but I think the same finding would apply to older people too, maybe to a smaller extent. What they did was they took some young adults and divided them into two groups. None of these people was a juggler. So they were just common, average people. So they randomized them to two groups. One group was taught how to juggle, and they were told to try juggling as much as they could. So they had to juggle three balls at a time. The other group was told not to try juggling. Otherwise, there was no change in their life. Either activities, nutrition, exercise, nothing changed. After 3 months of juggling, and they looked at their MRI. This was a regular MRI, not functional MRI, the regular structural MRI. They found that after 3 months, people who juggled, there was a significant increase in the gray matter of a part of the parietal lobe that is responsible for what is called perceptual anticipation. You know, in juggling, what the skill lies in putting your hand where the ball is going to land. And once you juggle up many times, you know exactly where to stick your hand. So the area of the brain that is responsible for that, that's the only part of the brain where there is increase in gray matter. None of the other areas were affected. But it's really remarkable that something as silly as juggling for 3 months can cause significant increase in the gray matter that you can actually measure on a regular MRI scan. So we are not talking about measuring the number of neurons. We are just looking at a regular brain scan. Now, we don't know what does that means, increase in gray matter. I don't think it means increase in number of neurons. That's less likely. But it might mean increase in number of synapses. It might mean increase in number of blood vessels. But clearly, it is something good. And the main point is that structural change in the brain can occur with an activity like juggling. This is in some ways even more exciting. This is a study of psychotherapy for people with schizophrenia. And in this study, they found that psychotherapy, again, I'm not talking about any physical activity, psychotherapy for 1 year produced a significant increase in the volume of gray matter in specific parts of the frontotemporal lobes. So what that means is that our brain is not rigid. Even in old age, it is capable of plastic changes under the right environmental, social, behavioral circumstances. And that's the neuroplasticity of aging. So, what does this all mean? And what can we do? Because ultimately, the goal for everybody is to age successfully and to be wise. What are the strategies for successful aging? Unfortunately, the most important strategy is calorie restriction. And number of studies, every single species have shown that calorie restriction helps. They're not talking about becoming malnourished or undernourished, but calorie restriction does help. Physical exercise is the second most evidence-based strategy. Any kind of exercise is better than no exercise. Aerobic exercise might be more useful, but even anaerobic exercise or weightlifting, muscle building exercise is also helpful. Non-toxic environment, cessation of smoking, for example, is useful. Optimizing stress, not stopping stress. That's of course not possible. But even if it were possible, it's good to have a little stress, so long as it is not overwhelming. And then there are something called superfoods that are rich in antioxidants. Things like broccoli, cabbage, spinach, carrots, blueberries, vitamin E, and curcumin, which is an Indian spice that is thought to be a good antioxidant and useful in animals. That is, the human data are still unclear. But these are all physical strategies. What about emotional, mental, psychosocial strategies? I'm sure you are all familiar with this number of products in the market. They're called brain aging, for example. And they say if you use our product, if you use this, then your brain will continue to grow. It is just like that baby Einstein. And there's no good evidence that any of them really works. What works is psychosocially stimulating environment, where you keep yourself active, positive attitude, learning new skills. And these are not just grandma style. There are actually well-controlled studies that show that things like learning new skills can have positive impact on functioning. The trick here is choosing something that is challenging but not too stressful. You don't want to do something that is too easy, too simple, that you always have been doing, because then it really doesn't challenge you. But you also don't want to do something that is too stressful. Learning a new language, for example, might be difficult for some people, might be quite possible for others. So it depends on each person. But the main point is that it is never too early nor too late to start. When does aging start? Aging starts at conception. Physical aging probably starts at early as 20, when there is evidence of degeneration of the knee cartilage. Clearly, there is aging that begins in middle age for several parts of the brain. I'll come back to that shortly. But so I talked about strategies for improving cognitive emotional aging. But are there strategies for improving wisdom? We don't know that yet. But this is a very new publication. Just came out a few months ago. This is a large social experiment that has been going on in the country at several sites through the so-called experience score. Very interesting program. What they do is they invite some older adult volunteers who work in elementary public schools. These are often schools in downtown for underprivileged kids. And these volunteers have to agree to spend at least 15 hours a week for the entire school year. And these volunteers, they serve as mentors and tutors in areas like literacy development, behavioral management skills, and the goal is to improve the children's academic success. This is not a research experiment, but it's really sort of social networking strategy. Nonetheless, the findings so far, the qualitative studies, suggest that such programs are not only successful in increasing academic success of the children, but also in activating and promoting the wisdom of aging. And really great example of how intergenerational activities can be mutually beneficial. It helps the kids who often may not have parents, let alone grandparents, and also help the older people who are often isolated. They don't feel useful. And here, so you meet each other's needs and both are helped. We have a paper that's coming out in the JAMA in the next probably couple of months. And in this paper, we argue that wisdom that increases with aging actually has an evolutionary significance. The thinking is this. In most species, the average lifespan is the same as the maximum lifespan. In humans, the maximum lifespan is 120 years. The oldest woman on record was a French woman who lived to, I think, 122 years or something. And there have been a few other people reported around that age. But most people agree that the maximum lifespan is 120 years. What is the average lifespan? The average lifespan in the U.S. today is 80 years. It used to be only about 45 years, 100 years ago. Now it has improved to 80 years. There's a big gap between 80 and 120. Even more important than the gap is the period of aging. The aging, human aging, begins at the very latest in middle age, 45, 50. So, and what happens in aging? Typically, the changes are there is degeneration, deterioration, diseases, disability. So, if human beings are supposed to start aging at 45, 50, with progressive degeneration, deterioration, decline, how can we be expected to live up to 120? And I think we are born to live up to 120. That's our speculation in this article. That means something must happen to compensate for the losses associated with aging. And we argued that something is probably wisdom. That wisdom probably tries to compensate for those losses. And how does it compensate? By improving the judgment, by improving emotional regulation, by improving our response to stress. So the things that are stressful, that are bothersome at a younger age, they no longer bother us as much. On the other hand, we take more pleasure in life. We are more self-contented, which actually improves the lifespan. Now, whether wisdom actually improves the lifespan, that's something to be studied yet. And how is that wisdom facilitated? Because of neuroplasticity of aging. So, if there is evidence that with better psychosocial stimulation and physical stimulation, our brain can continue to develop, I think that's very helpful. Because that would not only improve wisdom, but that would secondarily help improve the lifespan and longevity. We really need more research in this area. I mentioned about the studies we have been doing, those 3,000 seniors. We have recently begun a new study called SAGE, that stands for Successful Aging Evaluation. That is entirely funded by the Stein Institute. In this study, we have 1,300 randomly selected adults in San Diego County between the ages of 50 and 100. We have completed phone interviews on all 1,300 of them. And now we also have surveys completed by most of them. And the surveys include information not just on their health and behaviors like smoking, drinking, eating, but also on wisdom, resilience, optimism, their attitudes. In addition, we collect their saliva samples and we extract DNA so we can do some genetic studies on these people. And then our goal is to bring some of these people in for getting some brain imaging, cognitive testing, and various other things done. This is one of the examples of the studies for which we appreciate the community support. Because these are the studies that NIH doesn't fund, not at this level. Once we start collecting pilot data, then it will be supported. But at this stage, it's really predominantly the community support that helps. And our plan is to follow these people for as long a time as we can. There have been similar studies in the past, but they focus mostly on physical health and physical diseases. The unique feature of our study would be to focus on things like optimism, resilience, wisdom, and their contribution to well-being and health. So, this is my last slide. So, in summary, they said the basic concept of wisdom has remained remarkably similar across temporal and geographic boundaries, across thousands of years, and across tens of thousands of miles. Wisdom is a complex human trait with a neurobiological basis. Some people think that wisdom is just a convenient name for grouping some desirable traits. I don't think that's quite true. I think it is a specific trait, just like resilience and optimism. These are things that biological researchers in the past have ignored, but I think now emerging evidence that it is actually brain-based complex trait. Successful aging with increase in wisdom may have evolutionary significance. At the same time, we really need methodologically rigorous empirical research. One thing that has been lacking in this area is the kind of empirical research that is needed. We need exact definitions. We need appropriate measurement tools. We need large populations to study, and we should look at psychobiological as well as social markers of wisdom and aging. So let me stop here, and thank you for your attention.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.